From KCRW, this is DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. COVID-19 is still with us. What role can designers play in preventing infection or helping support immune strength?
When we engineer the ability for people to be physically active out of their lives, we are actually setting them up for type 2 diabetes.
Dr. Richard Jackson is a pediatrician who believes buildings and city design have a lot to do with public health. Hear from him in a moment. First up, though, most of us understand that we need to wear masks. That doesn't mean we actually like them.
So we did a survey over the past few weeks to get thousands of responses from people around the world to tell us, if you don't currently wear a face mask, why? Top ones included, they're too hot, I can't have a conversation, it hurts my ears, they fog up my glasses, I can't eat or drink while I'm wearing a mask.
Emily Musil Church is with XPRIZE. That's the nonprofit that was founded by the engineer Peter Diamandis some 25 years ago. His goal was to incentivize private spaceflight. Well, since then, XPRIZE has launched annual competitions to find novel technological solutions to some of our biggest challenges. Now enter COVID-19. And the very big challenge of getting people to wear masks. So XPRIZE has launched a competition to find great mask designs that solve the top 5 reasons people don't wear masks and that have an X factor of coolness and fashion. The competition is aimed at young people aged 15 to 24, and there is $1 million in prize money. Wow. So what's involved? Back to Emily Church.
Our young innovators around the world, ages 15 to 24, have until October 22nd to create a mask design. From there, we are going to announce top 25 teams. Those top 25 teams will go into a round, a manufacturing round, where they are partnered with manufacturers, and the top 10 will be distributed between manufacturing partners to actually work on getting those prototypes. Those prototypes of the masks that they designed are going to go into lab testing to look for breathability and filtration. We're asking for the filtration to be at least the equivalent of a surgical mask. And they're also going to go to a panel of global influencers or cultural ambassadors who will look at this X factor of coolness. You know, is this something that they would wear? So they can go and ask their audiences, their constituency, you know, to really try to address, why aren't we wearing masks? And is this something different that will make people use masks? The final round goes into our top 5 will go to a Shark Tank-like final competition where they will get to pitch their ideas to a panel of manufacturers, big brands. And at this point, there it will be more than just a design. It will be prototype tested. The grand prize is $500,000. And there are 2 additional bonus prizes that will be for the additional $500,000 of the prize purse. So a total of 3 prizes will be given out, cash prize.
It's a really interesting challenge. What level of presentation are you asking competitors to deliver?
So for that first stage, by October, what they need to create is a design, a computer-generated mask design, a letter of support from either a high school principal or a college tenured professor or administrator or a CEO of a relevant company. And then they'll do a short video of 1 to 2 minutes explaining the features of this mask, how it addresses the challenges, what makes it unique. And that's what they'll be submitting in October.
I have a feeling there'd be thousands of kids, young people, I should say, who would want to participate. However, as you know, thousands of them are now sitting on their own at home. It's a little bit harder, not for all kids. Some kids are very self-motivated, but some kids really benefit from being in a group, being in the classroom setting, perhaps having an engineering teacher at their school. How are you going to enable all these young people who are doing this in their bedrooms?
That's a great question. And actually, the idea for this first came out of, what are we going to do with all of these students who have great ideas and are stuck at home? And how can we really energize, get their ideas, and focus it towards solving a major problem? So part of it is actually knowing that there are all these young people who are at home. we really went back and forth thinking about, did we want to have people create a prototype of a mask or have it be a design? And part of the reason that we went for design, one, we didn't want to assume that young people have access to all of the materials it would take to actually produce a prototype. And we wanted to take the burden off of the young people so they could focus on the ideas for it. And then we create the partnerships to get them all of those connections they would need to be able to have the materials. So because it's a computer generated design, they would be able to communicate just as they would, you know, doing distance learning. Many of our young people right now are, just as you and I are on Zoom right now, are able to communicate that way. So we're assuming that there will still be collaboration. We hope for that. I do want to specify that we say in our rules and regulations that the design process has to be only for team members 15 to 24.
Do they have to know the fairly complex computer-aided drawing programs, the CAD programs that product designers or architects might use?
We have all of it laid out exactly what they can use. So yeah, we have, they would not have to know very detailed, difficult programs. So, but they would have to have at least sort of a general knowledge on how to make something on a computer, but we are providing resources on how to do that. Because part of what we want to do is just get people also who may not have thought about design before, to have resources to think about how could I change something from an idea I might have in my head to actually creating this. So that's part of what we hope, whether someone wins or not, they will be able to use their ideas for something that's happening in society right now and have resources to help them learn about what that looks like. Similar along the process, you know, talking about what it means to talk to a patent attorney to secure a patent, or manufacturing and what really happens with the global supply chain, and would this be an affordable type of mask based on the materials that they want to use in it. So there's a lot of opportunities for learning throughout the process.
So basically, are you asking people to take what we consider to be a regular mask, which covers the nose and the mouth and the chin and is somehow attached to the back of the head, and kind of rethink that? Or is it very open-ended? So, for example, if someone wanted to do a balaclava that has a mask built in, or if they wanted to do a turtleneck that becomes a mask, do they have flexibility?
Yes, and I love that you asked that question. We don't say what it has to look like. You'll actually notice if you go to our site, xprize.org/mask, you'll see that we purposely put a sort of abstract design on it, because the point is to get people sort of dislodged from this one notion about a mask. It's why we also did put in the filtration and breathability standard of a surgical mask to say, look, it's got to be able to work. You know, it's got to be able to actually protect you and others in your community. But what it looks like, how it functions, whether there's a shield on it, what materials, the shape, any of that, as long as it fits that one filtration standard, it could be whatever they imagine.
So fun. Well, it's a great competition. But I see that that there's other XPRIZE competitions that I think also relate to COVID-19. Can you just tell us about those?
Sure. Yeah, we launched at the end of June. So just a couple of weeks ago, we launched XPRIZE Rapid Reskilling, which is really a future of work XPRIZE. So that one has a $5 million prize purse and is open to innovators of all ages. So, you know, anyone from kids to however old you may be. And that one is, we were actually in design already to do something around future of work, because we know there are all sorts of trends in automation in the workplace and other things that as we were looking to say, what are the challenges moving forward? However, when COVID-19 hit and mass unemployment with numbers just skyrocketing, we slightly altered that design and we brought that launch sooner in order to address this specific crisis. So that one is, if you do XPRIZE Rapid Reskilling, you can find out about that competition. And that one's also open for registration through the fall. And then we have another one that's coming soon. I'm not sure if we're able to say what it is, but we will have a launch of one in another couple of weeks that is specifically responded, a specific response to COVID-19.
Well, Emily Church, it's really an exciting competition. It sounds great fun. Thank you very much for taking the time to tell us about it.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Emily Musil Church is with XPRIZE. The Next Gen Mask Competition is funded by Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff and CNN's Jim Cramer. See our website for more details. I'm Frances Anderton. We've just talked about protecting against COVID-19 infection through well-designed masks. How about immune strength and its connection with good design? It has been widely reported that people with underlying chronic conditions such as heart disease and type 2 diabetes are more susceptible to very serious consequences or death from COVID-19. So as we wait for a vaccine or a cure, is it worth thinking about immune health and how to remedy those chronic conditions? And that, says Dr. Richard Jackson, is where urban design and better buildings come in. Dr. Jackson is an emeritus professor at UCLA. He started his career as a pediatrician.
And I worked about 25 years on toxic chemicals and radiation and cancer clusters and other such issues. And it became clear to me by the late 1990s, I was the head of environmental health at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at CDC in Atlanta. And we were dealing with a lot of problems that in many ways were being driven by the physical environment that people were living in. Leading cause of death at that time was car crashes, again, related to the built environment. I became increasingly concerned about climate change and climate heating. And there are about 10 issues related to the built environment that cause climate heating, the removal of trees, blacktop roadways, excessive use of fossil fuels and pollution, greenhouse gas. And I thought, you know, to really change this negative trajectory we are on, we have to think about changing the physical environment. It came back over and over again to land use, built environment, urban planning, and architecture. And I and my colleague, Howie Frumpkin, we did a book on built environment health, urban sprawl, and public health. And we were speculating that depression had some of its causes in the isolation of where we build, that physical weakness was due to inactivity, the loss of fitness, that the increase of body weight was due to the fact that we're building environments that it's very hard. Most kids can't even walk to school any longer. In fact, when I was living in Atlanta close to UCLA, I could not go to my doctor's office walking up the stairs. I was compelled to take an elevator. So over and over again, we engineered physical activity out of people's lives. We also engineered a lot of the socialization that rewarded the lives of our parents and our grandparents and the physical activity that kids need for both their developmental and mental and physical health. So that's what led I and now many other health people into the world of planning and design.
So here we are with this pandemic, COVID-19, and the data suggests that a high proportion of the fatalities and very serious outcomes of this disease fall to people with certain underlying conditions, diabetes, obesity, heart conditions. So is there a connection between high susceptibility to the worst outcomes of COVID-19 and one's physical environment?
We know that people in very walkable communities weigh about 6 to 8 pounds less than people that live in the typical car-dependent sprawling community. When an adult goes to see a doctor, physician, and is told you have type 2 diabetes because of the hemoglobin A1C and because of the glucose and other issues, the first piece of advice the doctor is going to give is lose weight, watch your diet, and burn more calories. Be more physically active. Go back to the life that your grandparents had, for example. So when we engineer the ability for people to be physically active out of their lives, we are actually setting them up for type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is epidemic in our country at this point. In the U.S., we're about 11% of our adult population has type 2 diabetes, one person in nine. They have a disease that's going to cost them their eyes, their kidneys, and their feet. Now, the reason I'm talking about this is there's pretty good evidence that if you are overweight, you don't recover from many illnesses, including COVID, as well as someone who's not. Keeping your blood sugar in a normal range keeping your blood pressure in a normal range, being physically fit, makes you more resistant to illness, including this one. It doesn't mean, by the way, you're guaranteed a free pass. You don't want someone with COVID sneezing in your face.
Absolutely not. It's more in terms of making oneself a little bit less susceptible to the worst outcomes, I guess is the question here.
In order to deal with this disease, we've got to turn all the dials. We have to turn the nutrition dial. We have to turn the physical activity dial. At UCLA, we have the Healthy Campus effort. And one aspect of that is the so-called freshman 14, that kids start college and they gain weight. And it's partly because they're sitting and studying more. They're probably out drinking beer, or they're eating a lot more junk food because they're out of the family setting. And we've worked very hard to improve the diet for all the students on campus. We've created a garden there that students are actually working in, or supplying organic food for the activity. But one of the big things is to change the physical environment and make it a walkable campus. And we're working to try and have a bike route that would connect the two hospitals, one in Santa Monica and one at Ronald Reagan Hospital on UCLA campus. This is very interesting. The campus architect was very supportive that all new buildings on campus will have pleasant and attractive stairways. You'll actually have to go a little bit farther to get to the elevator. The old buildings from the 50s, and we all know this, you walk in and you can't figure out how you can go up a flight of stairs. You have to go search for a stairway. Well, that should be the welcoming part. And this is related to COVID in an odd sort of way. There are buildings in New York City where people are having to wait a half an hour or even an hour to be able to get on an elevator that they can isolate reasonably well on it, because you have to get up and down the building. But if it's 30 stories, you need to take an elevator. And the stairways tend to be dark and dirty and unlit and with no windows, so they're totally uninviting.
Stairways, though, excellent example. The elevator, in a way, is emblematic of a built environment that we've created for ourselves, which asks us to do as little as possible. Step outside of your house, get into your car, drive to work, get into the elevator to go to the office, go to the drinks machine to get yourself a drink. Very little physical effort demanded of us in every aspect of life. Are you suggesting that what we need is a little bit more kind of inconvenience built into our lives?
In 2003, I was invited by the American Institute of Architects to address their grassroots meeting. It was in a great big hall in Washington, D.C., hundreds of architects, and I stood there, and this is the first time I'd ever given a talk to this group, and I said, I want you architects to stop building buildings that have impossible to find stairways and that are dark and unpleasant for people to be in, and bad air quality. Build buildings with pleasant and attractive stairways. One flight of stairs a day for a year is equivalent to the caloric intake of 1 pound of body fat. And so the president of the American Institute of Architects came up to me, and I was waiting for him to chew me out. And he said, you know, Doc, we architects love stairways. We love vertical features, and we can do a lot with them, with the daylighting and the design. But you've got to get the fire marshals off our back, because they're supposed to be seen as rapid exit means and with heavy doors. And they really need to be built, as we did for thousands of years, as ways for people to get up and down without burning fossil fuels.
Sure. Let's apply everything that you've just laid out to the less privileged communities, the communities where one does see a high incidence of type 2 diabetes, of heart problems, of perhaps extra poundage. And yet these are neighborhoods also with very unpleasant streets, not the kind of streets you want to walk on. People might live in very small apartments, might not have access to a yard or even a deck, maybe not even a public park. And perhaps it's a food desert. There might not be a farmer's market there. There might not even be a sort of a decent grocery store. So you add all of those things together and you've got a pretty dismal set of circumstances for staying healthy. What do you recommend? And can you in your role impact that?
In the 1930s and 40s, some of the most attractive communities were largely African-American in the United States. Brownsville in Chicago, the area where Louis Armstrong lived in New Orleans. And with the so-called urban renewal, which my friends call urban removal, many of the highways were literally run through the poor black neighborhoods. So that loss of community has been very important. And the other thing that happened was, and I grew up in New Jersey, we had the so-called projects in Jersey City, Newark, and these other cities. And they were stacked buildings. One of them was about 30 stories, a couple of them in Jersey City were about 30 stories tall, with no sight lines, no good sound insulation. They were not built to encourage community. And my friend Bill Sullivan at the University of Illinois has done studies looking at how communities that are built with pleasant settings, with trees, with green space, are people socialize better and have better mental health than those that lack it.
You've already talked about staircases versus elevators. What are other features of the built environment that are either cure or ill?
You know, I think all of us care about, for example, the design of schools. And when I was a child, most of us were able to walk to school or even bicycle to school. And the schools were designed back in the 1920s. School design called for sunlight to the left side of the room, windows that open top or and bottom so you'd get a circulated air. Floors were, in most places, oak or wood, and they did not have carpeting, which is a reservoir for allergens and other such things. And by the way, they were incandescent lights. They weren't fluorescent lights that flickered. So we built very, very well. And then we decided in the 1960s, and I'm not making this up, the kids would learn better if there were no windows where they couldn't look out the windows. And then we decided that, oh, we ought to have metal detectors at the gates. And then we ought to build schools that have 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 students that no child can possibly walk to. In fact, my kids went to a high school in Atlanta where you could not walk to school. You had to be driven to get to school, even from five blocks away. It was too dangerous to do it. So we basically structured an environment to make these kids hyperactive, depressed, in desperate need of physical activity. And by the way, what are we going to feed them at lunch as we rush them through the dining area or the eating area, the converted gymnasium, is processed foods constantly. So we've constructed an unhealthy environment for our kids. And the physical environment's one part of it, but the nutritional environment, the advertising environment, the cultural environment are just as worrisome.
You worked for a time at the CDC. Did you have these conversations there? Were you able to? Is it something that the CDC is even interested in terms of health outcomes?
In 1997, I was in the director's office when the staff in the physical activity group came in, and CDC writes a lot of the Surgeon General's reports. And this was the Surgeon General's report on the need for physical activity. And there was a presentation, and at the end, all sitting around this oak table and 20 people. And I finally said, I don't think CDC is entitled to release this report. And the director, Dr. David Satcher, wonderful man, looked at me and said, why, Dick? You know, this is important. I said, no, there's not a sidewalk within 2 miles of CDC. You cannot bicycle to CDC. We have no physical activity. We don't have walking trails on this campus. We've done everything to make people automobile dependent and to isolate them down to this moving box all the time. And we need to commit to safety, physical activity, lower carbon footprint. And he actually, he's a wonderful man. He said, you know, Dick, you're right. We've got to put this report out, but we will learn from it. And a few years later, it was really 10 years, there was the new Surgeon General's report that said we need to build environments that encourage that physical activity. So, and by the way, this was deeply, what I'm saying was deeply unpopular with the National Association of Home Builders. Home building is a way to take former agricultural fields and you buy them for, you know, $50,000 an acre. You put $100,000 worth of house on it and you turn around and sell it for $350,000, $400,000. It's almost a license to print money. And it's all done for the purpose of money. It's not done for the purpose of creating nurturing, healthy communities for the young, for the old, and everyone in between. And there's a lot we can do. I grew up close to New York City, and many of my friends grew up in apartment buildings. And honestly, they loved it. They were old brownstones with good thick walls. There was decent heating. There were always kids around. If you were elderly, there were always other people around. If you weren't feeling well, there were people that looked in on you and checked on you. There were usually good sight lines. The windows were recessed, but you could see out on what was going on the street. There was often a big stoop, and everybody met their neighbors on the stoop. Now we have air conditioning, so nobody wants to sit outside on a hot summer day. And now we've got wonderful color TV and streaming with, you know, 1,000 channels with nothing to watch. And so we isolate ourselves in these boxes that we've created. And then the boxes that we make for the poor, the rental units, are often inadequate sound insulation. You need double layers of sheetrock if you really want to stop sound penetrating a wall, and maybe even more mass than that. We need to build places that have the sight line, the natural features, whether it's landscaping or greening, and ways that, and a welcoming spot where people can come together. Jonathan Rose built Via Verde in the South Bronx, very poor part of South Bronx, had an apartment manager, building manager. It was highly sustainable. They actually put a flat top with fruit trees on the roof in a welcoming spot that you can look around and meet your neighbors. And of course, wide stairways that invited you to go up. And by the way, that was before we knew we had to stay 6 feet away from people.
Would you like to have been an architect or a town planner?
I grew up very poor, one of seven children in Newark, New Jersey. Well, my dad died when I was three. And I had no idea there were such careers as being an architect. And I was seen way beyond my reach. And I don't have enough of the artistic sense. I'm pretty good at memorizing. So medicine was a good profession for me. And I like people in general. And so that was good as well.
Do you feel you get a hearing from developers?
Yes and no. The first time I started talking about this, the National Association of Home Builders agitated to get 24 members of Congress to write to the head of CDC and tell Dr. Copeland that they should fire me because CDC should fire me because the guy's a crackpot. But over time, it's got a very good listening. And I would say some of the leaders of the Urban Land Institute who are developers have really taken this to heart. And there have been some very, very smart developments. But the pressure that they're getting from the banks, from the lenders, from other sources to get that rapid return is crazy.
You've mentioned developments and examples in various parts of the country. Are there any developments in Los Angeles or changes that have been made to the urban fabric that have particularly struck you?
I think one very important one, and this was a passion of me for several years, was the reclamation of the Los Angeles River. The Los Angeles River, what a spectacular asset this is. It's 55 miles. It runs through some beautiful areas to the north of the city, but south of the city, as every Los Angelino knows, it's paved over. It was used for the filming of The Terminator. It's a concrete sluice to take water, which Los Angeles has been desperate for and will increasingly be desperate for, and sluice it out to the Pacific Ocean, filled with debris and shopping carts and other such things. That river needs to be reclaimed. It needs to be widened. It needs to be used as a groundwater recharge. But it also goes through the poorest, least physically active, most obese, most diabetes, least amount of access to fruits and vegetables, least amount of parks in all of Los Angeles. And that should be a beautiful linear park with natural features so kids could actually go up and see what a stork or a crane would look like as they go through. Yes, it's going to cause a certain amount of gentrification because people do like to live near water. So I think we've got to figure out ways that we can fix the physical environment without displacing people who live there for generations, who have built social capital, and we need to protect them in that process.
And just to conclude, though, in terms of what we are learning from COVID-19 and how we might move forward into the future, would you say that we should be factoring in the built environment as part of that discussion?
I think the big lesson of the pandemic of COVID is that none of us can do this alone. Yes, we're going to wear a mask. Yes, we're going to be socially distant, but we've got to take care of ourselves and take care of each other and build places that are pleasant, that we want to be in, that people want to stay in.
Well, Dr. Richard Jackson, it's a pleasure and an honor to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
This has been a treat, and your questions and thoughts are really provocative and useful and helpful to me.
Dr. Richard Jackson is a pediatrician, and he's Professor Emeritus at the Fielding School of Public Health at the University of California. He advises municipalities about creating healthy places. He's co-authored several books on the topic, and he hosted a PBS series called Designing Healthy Communities. Get links on our website. And if you want to listen to more DNA reports on KCRW about these kinds of topics, subscribe to the DNA newsletter. Find it at kcrw.com/newsletters. Thank you for listening to the DNA podcast. Stay tuned and stay well.